Say That, the podcast where your big questions get real answers. My name is Matt King. I'm your host from the city of Chicago. Joining us here is Jed Brewer.
Greetings.
Who is all the way from Rutgers, Tennessee, is Lee Younger.
I'm already tired from the amount of insanity that we have talked about offline.
That's right.
Totally fair.
There's an entire pre-show that is, well, is it funnier than the real show? Hard to say. Is it more slanderous in a way we cannot record? Yes.
Yeah. It's for the Patreon. If you guys want to pony up, then you can get access. But until you do, you don't get anything.
We have not discussed this amongst nothing. Ourselves because I'm not sure there's a level of money that people could pay for me to say some of the things I say in the pre-show.
Fair.
In a recorded medium.
Come on, man. If the dollar amount was right, the fizzy lifting drink is available to everybody.
Well, when you put it that way.
I'm trying to figure out if that reference works within the context of the Willy Wonka, because the fizzy lifting drink is the thing that gets them in trouble, but it's too twisted a web to go down right now.
That's right.
Well,
speaking of podcasts, speaking of money, speaking of lies upon lies, as is part of the conceit of the classic children's movie Willy Wonka. You never know if adults are lying to you, and also here's candy. That's a fun lesson for the children. We turn. Before we get to your fine questions this episode, we turn to a podcasting emergency.
Oh.
This is a weird one.
Seems a little
for us.
Close to home, Matt.
Yeah, not normally the type of story we cover on the show, but we do have an insane church thing, so don't worry about that.
We'll get there.
But if you've been on the social medias, particularly TikTok, while it's still legal on these shores, and like an Instagram or anything that has video, you may notice there's been a, particularly post-pandemic, a huge uptick in kind of random white guys who have a podcast with a little background behind them, and they're just talking about stuff and clipping it for the internet. There may have been a time on this show, we tried video for a little while on this show, couldn't really make it work, and that was definitely before any of us knew how to edit video. It was also before any of us had as involved a jobs as we do now, so we will not be taking video and clipping it for the social media, because at this point in my life, and I think I speak for my co-host, nothing positive comes from me going viral.
we're not aiming at popularity.
No, we didn't hit it, and now we stopped aiming at it, and that's a way you can help your goals be more achievable.
Yeah.
You've been doing something for 10 years and it's clear that it's not going to go a certain way, so you can stop gauging success by that metric. That's helpful.
Yeah.
But you may have noticed that, they'll clip these little things, they do well, and it's often someone pretending, or maybe is just incredibly stupid. There was one that went viral a couple weeks ago from when we recorded this, where a guy was being very angry that he was like in his 20s, and no one had ever told him that a quarter past the hour was 15 minutes and not 25 minutes, because a quarter is 25 cents, so why wouldn't a quarter be 25?
Wow, okay.
And, engaging content like that. But also you've noticed if you listen to podcasts that aren't this one where people do care about making money, there's a big tick up in podcast ads. That's become a thing. And since we started doing this show, dynamically inserted ads, the targeting is not great. I got one in German the other day. I don't speak German. Podcast wasn't in German. None of the other ads were in German. Still not really sure how that one's slid in there, but, somebody paid for it. Apparently they,
well, you are friends with a guy whose last name is Brewer.
Well,
is that racist towards Germans?
I don't know.
Also, I do digital marketing in my day job. I don't think the surnames of your friends is something that can be targeted at this point, but I also wouldn't put it past them.
Nah, man, you don't need to underestimate the AI at this point, Matt King.
I don't think it's possible to underestimate the AI at this point, but that's an entirely different discussion. For now, we get back to this. So basically, there are people who are doing ads on TikTok or Instagram, whatever. But instead of it's just some guy and he's looking at the camera, and he's like, take the supplement and you'll be immortal, or whatever they say. That's the implication of most of the supplement ones, I think. If you take this green thing and mix it into your drink, You'll become more powerful than you can possibly imagine. But what they're doing is they're putting up an ad that's a podcast segment. But here's the thing. There's no podcast. We now are in such a weird world where people are pretending to have podcasts just so they can do the ad part and put that on social media. And I hope that sounds strange to you, dear listener, because as three guys who've been doing podcasts for a while, it sounds strange to us.
So there's no content?
No, there's just the clip of the ad.
And they post that on a social media platform?
Yes. I read from Bloomberg talking about this phenomenon. In these clips, an actor, MJ Wolf, sits in front of a microphone so you, the viewer, think you've happened upon a podcast midway through the show. He might be looking off camera like he's speaking to someone else in the studio or wearing headphones. There could be a neon sign hung up on a brick wall behind him, a la Joe Rogan's podcast. He will talk about a product, casually mentioning its benefits and why he loves it. Maybe you'll think this podcast feels slightly excessive in its enthusiasm for a particular thing, but TikTok's content onslaught doesn't leave much room for questioning. The takeaway is, he's a passionate person speaking authoritatively on a podcast. Apparently, having a podcast is now, in certain marketplaces, a sign of authority.
Wow. Wow. You know, as someone who's been involved with a podcast, and actually a few podcasts for a long time, I have no authority. I want to be very clear about that. I am not in a position of authority.
Well, not with that attitude, Jed.
Every place where I thought I had authority, I wound up not having it.
Yeah. Well, especially so the arc for your three intrepid hosts here of having a podcast is from about 2012 to 2019. You told someone, "Oh, I need to leave dinner early, a little bit early. I have to go record my podcast," or they ask you what you're doing. "Oh, and record podcast night." Almost universally, you met with the phrase, "What is that?"
Sure.
Yeah.
And then you would give an explanation that essentially you would have to at some point go into, it's essentially a fake radio show that lives on someone's phone.
That's right. If they want it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not forced on anyone's phone for now.
That's right.
So there was that. And then, like, I don't know, maybe it was before that, 2017, 2018, whenever Serial came out, there'd be some people who were like, "Oh, I know what that is now. Are you NPR?" And you'd be like, "No, we're not NPR. We just do it out of
our..." Are you This American Life?
No.
No.
Very much not.
We're American Life.
Yes. We do it out of various basements. Our lives are in America. It's kind of that. And then, again, post-pandemic, we kind of went, from our perspective, from in the blink of an eye, no one knowing what this was, to no one caring what it was, to now, just the very concept of a white guy having a podcast is risible.
Yeah.
With good reason, yeah. Don't get me wrong. But I guess all I'd say, this feels a little bit like stolen podcast valor, guys, that somebody's just doing the making money part without ever having to explain to their aunt at a family thing when your dad has horrifically tried to explain to them what a podcast is. And they bring you their flip phone. Like, "Can you put it on this?" You're like, not really, no.
Hold on. People are making money off of podcasts. We've done podcasts longer than anybody's done podcasts. We've made more podcasts than basically anybody's ever made podcasts. And we've never made a nickel. Like, we've never made any money. That's issue number one.
Definitely.
Okay. That's issue number one. Issue number two is, man, I feel like we've put some good stuff out there, and I don't feel like enough people are listening to it. But I've never advertised anything.
Well, let me give you some numbers that are going to make you sad, Lee.
Oh, no.
This article from Bloomberg is about a guy named MJ Wolf, who's an actor who's doing this. He's being paid $195 for each of these one-minute advertisements designed to look like a podcast on a freelance website, Fiverr, where he makes what's, quote, user-generated content video ads. The custom neon sign he can put in the background is an upcharge. So $195 is the base rate. His online ad business brings in anywhere from $9,000 to $16,000 a month, but not all his ads are, and I quote, podcast style.
Wow.
Which sounds like the worst way to get your fries at a burger joint. Do not go into In-N-Out and ask for podcast style. They'll be like, you want to eat it alone? That's fine. So, yeah, just a little rant from some guys who've been doing podcasting for a while and came across a weird story. But now...
For a while?
For longer than I've done almost anything else. At this point, longer than I was in primary school, elementary through high school.
Longer than your Duolingo streak, man.
Yes, indeed. And also, but we are all podcasters in the traditional method, meaning when people in real life at work or whatever mention something and I'm on a video call and they happen to see like a piece of equipment or something, they're like, what's that? I'm like, nothing. You do not tell them you have a podcast because it's a secret shame for you and your internet friends.
A secret shame. So I saw a thing recently. It was one of these like, you know, reels or TikToks or whatever. And it was a couple of white guys talking on, obviously on a podcast. They're in a couple of SM7s, you know, with headphones on or whatever. And a guy says to another white guy, did you know there are more trees in Canada than there are stars in the universe? And the other white guy goes, wow. And then it cuts to an African-American general, gentleman who says...
Could be a general. We don't know.
Could be a general. An African-American gentleman who says, you know what? It's too easy for white guys to get podcasting equipment.
Yeah.
Classic.
Now you got your kind of home audio, your Zencasters, and you don't even have to edit it together. It's the barrier to entry has been lowered to a point that may be unhelpful.
Not more trees in Canada than stars in the universe, fella.
Speaking of things that may need a higher barrier to entry and jobs that may need a higher barrier to entry.
Okay.
I bring you this headline from the Huffington Post. Megachurch pastor responds to accusation that he plagiarized apology for sexist joke.
Wow.
So this is from the It Gets Worse department. Texas megachurch pastors apologized for delivering a sexist joke during a recent sermon. But now he's addressing claims that his mea culpa was plagiarized.
Wow.
So this dude went on stage during a sermon, and he said something just deeply, unpleasantly sexist in a very, like, 80s sitcom kind of line. And it was in February. The clip gets pulled out and circulated on various social medias. I don't know if they made any ad money off it. But this guy starts getting ripped apart, very rightly. And he goes to apologize. Now, you may think you wouldn't need to plagiarize an apology because you used to say, sorry about that. Shouldn't have said that thing.
I super screwed up. I really, really beefed it.
Turns out, and here's something new to me that I learned this week, women are people. So obviously, if I'd known that at the time, I wouldn't have said that. But, you know, you live and you learn.
Well, you know, we were talking just a few minutes ago about the limitations of AI. And just as a test, I've gone onto ChatGPT and I have asked it to write an apology for a thing that I should not have said in my sermon. So can I deliver our AI fueled apology and you gentlemen see what you think?
Please.
Okay. So let me ask, cause I mean, there are many, in terms of the delivery, there's many pastoral voices that I could use. Do we want this to be kind of the high budget megachurch pastor?
Well, I think it would have to be that guy, but he's trying, it would have to be his version of the, I'm wearing a jeans and a button down shirt that's rolled up, because he's got to sound folksy and of the people. This is the this isn't the high Sunday we're recording this. This is hey y'all, just before we get started.
Hey y'all, before we get started,
that's good. That's earnest.
Yeah. I want to offer my sincerest apologies for my inappropriate behavior during the recent sermon. It deeply troubles me to acknowledge that my actions were disrespectful and they were offensive to you, the congregation, and to the sanctity of our worship space. Yelling "Hail Satan" was not only disruptive, but it was It was also completely antithetical to the message of love and of grace and of reverence that I aim to convey in my sermons. I understand that my words may have caused confusion, hurt, and discomfort among those present, and for that I am truly sorry. I deeply value the sacred trust that you have placed in me as your pastor, and I'm dedicated to rebuilding that trust through my words and actions and ongoing commitment to serving this congregation with integrity and humility. How'd we do?
That's good. That's good. I like that. In my defense, I was just thinking of the Mountain Goat song, the best ever death metal band out of Denton. Just happened to yell "Hail Satan" into the microphone.
Yeah. Hold on, Matt.
It's a very catchy tune.
To be fair, you're thinking of the Mountain Goats like 30% of the time anyway.
Well, that's true. That is fair.
It's, you know, they sent him to the special school. They told him he'd never be famous. It's a heartbreaking tale.
Absolutely. When you punish someone for dreaming a dream, bad things happen.
This is no doubt about that. Now, I like that, Jed. Now, I think it was a little too not weirdly churchy, because there's more off-putting stuff in the real apologies.
Okay.
So you referred to you, the congregation. Yep. You actually used the second person there as if you were talking to like a thing that's made up of people, and not just a thing you're in charge of. This dude said, and I'm quoting his actual apology here, "If that joke fell on you the wrong way, I need you to hear three things. Number one, I love you. Now listen, Lake Point Church," which is a fun way to regress a group of individuals made in the image of God. "I love you more than you'll ever imagine. Number two, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for something that felt like careless words." Let me rephrase that. "I'm sorry for careless words. I'm sorry about that. Number three, thank you for your grace to me. I wanted to be doing this with you for decades and decades and decades."
Here's, that's not an apology.
Not an apology.
Not at
all. It is eerily similar to this this section of a sermon given in August of 2022 from a Florida megachurch pastor who had probably said some equally stupid crap in his sermon. "Church, I need you to hear this, okay? Three things. I love you. I love this church." So already, I mean, the second guy named the church.
"Yep.
I love getting to do this thing together. And again, I'm sorry. I want to say thank you. Thank you for the grace you've given me every single week and to stand up here and do what I get to do. And I hope, by God's grace, I'll get to do this for decades and decades to come."
Wow.
So we're talking about AI here. Now, you may notice if you've used ChatGPT or if you've heard the coverage, my understanding of it is a large language model is what all these things are. And the thing about AI, to the current level of it, is they talk about it like thinking or deciding, or it doesn't do that. It's just basically got all the words and is trying to use a statistical model to say what word comes next. And to that point, I would say, are megachurch pastors just AI already?
Okay.
If we can't find in this text like a thought or an intention or an analysis. It's just kind of, what word would a megachurch guy use next? And then they kind of string that together.
I have something I think we're going to enjoy. I have given ChatGPT a new prompt. I have specifically asked for a smarmy non-apology. I think you're going to really like where this goes.
Now, before Jed starts, listener, I just want you to take a moment to think to yourself, is this going to be better or worse than the actual church megachurch pastor's apologies? Place your bets now.
Okay, let me get set. Hey, I feel compelled to address the recent incident during my sermon. It seems there was some confusion and perhaps a touch of offense taken at my exclamation of "Hail Satan." While I can understand how some might have been momentarily startled, I assure you it was all in good humor. Let's be honest, we could all use a bit of levity now and then, even in the solemnity of a sermon. My intention was merely to inject a bit of unexpected spontaneity into the proceedings, but I see now that not everyone shares my irreverent sense of humor. If my exuberance caused any discomfort, I offer my deepest condolences to those with more delicate sensibilities.
Oh,
rest assured, It was never my intent to ruffle any feathers. Let's chalk it up to a momentary lapse in judgment and move forward with a renewed commitment to maintaining decorum in the future.
That sounds more human than the one deferring to people as church.
Well, here's what I love is if you ask for a non-apology, ChatGPT knows exactly what that is.
Oh, that's yeah. right. That's right.
Yeah. yeah.
That's right.
Here's the thing. Very few people are funny. And that bell curve's going to follow on to pastors. So maybe just try to be helpful for 15 minutes and then sit
that's
down.
That's right.
If you do that for a few years, maybe you can drop a yuck yuck in there every once in a while. But and just to be clear, the two offensive, quote unquote, the things that people took offense to, the first one, the guy in Florida who was the plagiarized E, made some weird joke about breastfeeding being gross.
Nope.
So don't do that.
Wow, dude. Yeah. Please.
Here's the thing I know, and I'm not a parent and I'm not a woman. And that puts me in two categories where I don't have any opinions on what your baby eats.
That's right.
Are you feeding your baby? Great.
Ah, great.
Is it formula? Great. Is it breast milk? Great. Seems like this is a, being that I am neither a parent, a mother, or a pediatrician, I have absolutely no opinions.
Also, if I'm not in your family, it's not my business.
Yeah. So a Texas dude was making some, I think he was trying to joke on something, but the quote is, Howerton said that on a couple's wedding night, a woman should, quote, I can't stress the quote part enough for the words I'm about to say into a microphone, stand where he tells you to stand, wear what he tells you to wear, and do what he tells you to do to make her husband the happiest man in the world.
Nope, 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 nope.
Don't say that, bro.
And we're supposed to think this is a joke?
Well, after no one laughed.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, here's what you think. When the backlash hit, Howerton told his congregation he needed to address a thing, explaining that his earlier remarks were a joke. You can't assign a statement joke status afterwards. Like,
no.
The rest of us learn in about third grade that you can't do that to get out of trouble. You can't be like, did you tell Timmy that you hated him and you hope he fell down in traffic? Like, well, I was just joking. That's not a get out of jail free card. You can't do that.
Nope.
Wow.
Yeah. So don't do that. These are things it's fine to have no opinion on.
That's right.
Like if someone comes to you in your pastoral role for premarital counseling and asks about wedding night advice, I guess in broad strokes, because it's easy to get weird. But you shouldn't tell them that. But then you can't stand in front of everyone and be like, oh no, I'm going to call my buddy who also says stupid things in his sermon and see how he got out of it. And then just say those words.
Yeah. That's not a situation to joke about as a person who's done.
Nope.
Like a lot of premarital counseling. But regardless, that's definitely not the way to do it.
Also, and just aside from the horrific sexism of it, which I don't want to discount, the logic underpinning that one seems to be, you know who has all their thoughts together and a plan of action is a young man who just got married.
Yeah.
And that's, there's some flaws in that logic.
Oh, gosh.
And with that, we're going to declare wow. emergencies off.
Oh, wow. Christians.
Yeah. With that, we're going to move on to your fine questions. If you have a question for us, you can have us all the way to the end, or I'll give you some ways to get in touch with us. You can scroll down to your episode description to find those. First question comes in and says, I recently saw someone saying that when the Bible talks about modesty, it means not showing off your wealth. I like that a lot more than it being about covering your shoulders, but is that actually accurate? And a fantastic question. And Jed, where do we start off here?
It is a great question, and so let's look at a couple of things. I want to kind of answer your specific question right away and then maybe suggest just something to ponder. So, the New Testament talks repeatedly about not flaunting your wealth. And it also talks in no uncertain terms about not showing favoritism to the wealthy. And it's worth noting that, this is a rough estimate, but that about half of modern problems in society come from ignoring that second bit of advice.
Hello.
So it turns out that giving preferential treatment...
Can't hear you from the VIP section here at church, Jed.
The skybox at the Baptist church.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it turns out that giving, you know, kind of preferential treatment to the wealthy, that gets bad for society writ large very quickly. And that goes way beyond the church or religious institutions generally. That goes sour very, very quickly. And it's very hard to put that particular genie back in the bottle. So that's really something to be very, very careful with. But again, within the context of Christianity, within the context of church, the New Testament's super clear that flaunting your wealth is a bad idea. And again, a parallel idea that showing favoritism to the wealthy or showing kind of prejudicial treatment against people who are impoverished, either way, that these are very, very bad ideas. It's also worth noting, and this doesn't get brought up very much, but it's really worth noting that even if we were talking about the idea of clothing modesty or modesty in kind of a sexual context, that is highly culturally dependent, like highly, highly, highly culturally dependent. And so if your idea is that whatever calls may exist in the Bible to kind of shows of sexual modesty, of modesty regarding, you know, how revealing your clothing is, we want to be careful to not be viewing that through the lens of white ethnocentrism, because there actually isn't anything inherently more holy about suburban American culture than there is about other cultures anywhere else in the world. So a lot of what's happened, certainly in the 20th and 21st century in American churches when it comes to ideas of sexual modesty, are really just trying to baptize our cultural norms and insisting that that everyone else has to follow them and that it's holy so to do, which that is quite a stretch from what is actually in the Bible. So I think we definitely want to bear that in mind. But here's the bigger thing that I really want to encourage you to think about. This isn't something where there's an immediate answer that I want to point to, but I want you to think about this. And it actually links back to the just awful stuff from the so-called pastor that we were talking about in that emergency just a minute ago. Here's my question for you. Why are you assuming that the haters have a point? When someone who is a misogynist happens to read the Bible and quotes a verse to you and says, you have to do this, why are you assuming that they have a point? It's worth remembering that slave owners quoted the Bible and said, you have to let us have slaves. It's worth noting that people that have committed horrific acts of anti-Semitism have quoted the Bible and said, you have to let us commit horrific acts of anti-Semitism. No one with any scholarship, no one who I think is thinking clearly would look at either of those and be like, oh, well, I really have to hear them out. No, you super don't. If you're pro-slavery, you're wrong. If you're pro-anti-Semitism, you're wrong. Similarly, if you are a pro-misogyny, you are wrong. To persecute anyone, but particularly to persecute someone on the basis of their gender, their gendered identity, their gender expression, that is contrary to the heart of Jesus Christ. And it is contrary to what Paul wrote when he said that in Christ there is neither male nor female, for all are one in Jesus Christ. There is this weird thing in Christian culture where if someone has the title of pastor or deacon or bishop or whatever, and they are claiming to be coming from, you know, a biblical point of view, that like you have to hear them out. No, you don't. No, you don't. In my world, if you want me to hear you out, earn it. Start there. Earn it. Don't earn it with your so-called title. Don't earn it with your so-called degree. Live a life that is worthy of respect. Earn it that way. If you want me to take my time and hear you out, earn it. Someone who says, well, I'm Pastor so-and-so, and I've read this Bible, and it says women have to do whatever I tell them to do. Dude, you haven't earned anything from me. If anything, you're telling me someone that I need to be very careful around and get away from as quickly as possible. The world is full of haters. Many of them, unfortunately, wear a clerical collar and quote the Bible. You don't have to assume that they have a point. You don't have to argue with them. You don't have to hear them out. You don't have to debunk their logic. You can say, nope, and walk away. And I would encourage you to give yourself a lot of latitude to, as we say in Chicago, to do that early and to do that often.
Indeed. Election season is coming up. As often as you like. Great stuff there. And Lee, where do we close this out?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with where Jed has started us off here. And I would just make a couple of points. One, there's no possible way to make the point that this was about, that immodesty in dress was about the lust issue. Either in a cultural sense or contextually. So when you read, like, particularly the passage in the letter of James, James was a pastor of a church in Jerusalem in the first century in Palestine. There was no, there just factually was no what we would consider like a lustful immodesty in dress in that time. So like there's no way that he can be talking about that because it didn't exist. Everyone, like all of the women in the city of Jerusalem in the first century in Palestine dressed with robes going all the way to the ground, like flowing robes, many with covering their head and their faces and stuff like that. Like it just didn't exist. So that's part of the problem with interpreting James's words to be about, like, you know, wearing, you know, sensual clothing or something like that. It just didn't exist. The other thing is just, you just read the you just simply read the chapter. You read the chapter and he is exactly as Jed's saying. He's obviously talking about showing favoritism to those who are wealthy. Okay. So completely agree with Jed on all that stuff, but let's take a second to deal with the other side of this. The other side of this is that the argument is that if a person dresses quote unquote immodestly, so they dressed in whatever, I don't know, sexy clothing or something like that, that you are somehow causing someone to commit the sin of lust because you are making yourself attractive to them. Okay. We need to deal with that piece of this whole argument because, I have to state this as clearly as I possibly can. If you are a person, no matter how you dress, if someone is committing the sin of lust against you, that has nothing whatsoever to do with anything you did or how you dressed. The biblical infraction of lust is all about another person's mind and heart. It has nothing to do with your actions or your dress. And that needs to be as clear as possible. Jed is exactly right. This contextually and culturally, there is absolutely no way to read these passages in the letter of James in any other way than about wealth distribution. But for those who do argue the lust component, it needs to be super, super clear. The sin of lust is completely the responsibility of the person who is committing the sin of lust. It is not about the dress or the action or the behavior of the person that they are committing the sin of lust against. This is not an issue where, well, I, I, I wouldn't have lusted against this person if they hadn't been wearing that particular outfit or whatever. No, we cannot transmute that offense to anybody else. And that's an incredibly important thing. I remember when I had been on a pastoral staff for maybe like 2.5 years, and somebody in our church wrote an email to our pastor and said, I think you need to talk to so-and-so. This was a young woman in our church, because the way that they are dressing is causing me to have, you know, lustful feelings about them. And our...
Just put that in writing, did you?
Just put it out there, just right there on the email. And our pastor said, please meet me at the church at your earliest convenience, and said, do not come here again until you have settled this issue. This has nothing to do with this young woman. This has everything to do with you. I will meet with you and help you work this out, but this has everything to do with you and nothing to do with her. I will not entertain any more conversations that have anything to do with her behavior, her outfits, her dress, anything else. So we just need to be super clear about that side of this whole issue. Jed's exactly right. This is all to do with wealth. This is all to do with wealth, and it has to do with showing favoritism. But we need to deal with the other side of this, which is however you dress, somebody else's lust is not on your account. We just need to say that out loud so that you understand that that is absolutely the case. You are not causing somebody else to stumble. And that was the language of the, particularly the Baptist church in the 90s. You are not causing somebody else to stumble because you wore that top.
Yes, absolutely right. Unless possibly that top is festooned with gold coins, in which case you may be indirect. Contradiction to what's written in the New Testament. Other than that, probably fine. All great stuff from both of these guys. We'll move on to our next question here. It comes in and says, what's the difference between a toxic person and just a sinful person? We're supposed to forgive everyone and everybody has flaws, but they say it's also okay to let go of toxic people in your life. Is that right? And where do I draw that line? I think another fantastic question. And Jed, where do we start off here?
Man, it's a great question. Love it. When we're trying to understand something, one of the most useful tools that we have in our arsenal is to try and drop all of the buzzwords, all the technical terms, and see, can we explain it without using any of those words? And I think we can, and I think we should. So here is my question back to you. Is there someone in your life who consistently makes your life worse? If so, you should change your relationship with them.
That's right.
We can describe them as toxic, we can describe them as sinful, we can describe them as a huge jerk, doesn't really matter. If there's someone in your life who consistently makes your life worse, you should change your relationship with them. It is true, and it is pretty hard to miss, that as Christians, we are called to love other people, that's true. But sometimes love has to happen from a distance, and sometimes from a very, very far distance, and that's okay. What I can tell you is that for me, if I leave interactions with another person consistently feeling bad about myself, I'm going to limit my interactions with that person, pretty significantly. We can use whatever vocabulary that we want to, and whatever vocabulary we prefer and we choose, but that dynamic of, hey, you make me feel really bad about myself, so I'm gonna not do that. That's good. Like drawing that line is a really, really good idea. Similar to the previous question, I think it's worth digging in. And I think for you, it's worth kind of, you know, doing the thought experiment and kind of thinking through of like, why wouldn't you do that? Who and what have been telling you that you have to put up with people that mistreat you and with people that make you feel bad about yourself? I want to read your question one more time. You wrote, what is the difference between a quote-unquote toxic person and just a sinful person? We're supposed to forgive everyone and everybody has flaws, but it's okay to let go of toxic people in your life. Is that right? I don't know about you, but what I can say is there's a huge difference between a person that generally treats it reasonably well and every once in a blue moon has a bad day and is kind of cranky.
Yeah.
Versus someone who consistently makes you feel bad about you, where you leave your interactions feeling drained, feeling crappy, feeling used up, maybe just feeling used. On the one hand, yeah, we all have bad days. We all have days where we wake up on the wrong side of the bed and we're a little cranky and we're a little bit on edge. If you're an adult, you should be mindful of that and not just give full vent to your crankitude. And, you know, if you find that you're being sharp with other people, owning up to that, hey, man, I'm sorry. I didn't sleep well last night. I'm being cranky. I apologize for that. Let me try and rephrase that. Again, I think most of us are prepared to be understanding about that. I mean, that's kind of a, you know, we all need that understanding, you know, here and there. But that's, again, that's a categorically different thing from, hey, man, 9 times out of 10, when we hang out, I leave feeling bad. I'm going to not do that anymore. And I think critically, you know the difference between those two things. We don't have to use the word toxic or sinful or anything else, but you know the difference between those two experiences. And super important, people who are not trying to get away with something also know the difference between those two experiences. Your question reads to me, and I could be wrong, and I hope that I'm wrong, but your question reads to me that you have a person in your life who is mistreating you and trying to get away with it. And so they are giving you a speech about, well, you're a Christian. You're supposed to love people. You know, everybody has flaws. I got flaws. You got flaws too, bro. So, you know, we gotta figure this thing out. I mean, I guess it's all just, you know, cancel culture. And if somebody's toxic, I guess you just cancel them. I guess that's what we're doing. You know what? When I was growing up, we talked about love. So, you know what, I guess if you just don't have any more love in your heart for me, I guess I understand. I guess I'm just too toxic for you. But like, yeah, I will be loving you whether you can love me back or not. Okay. I have a feeling that you've been hearing speeches like that. And here's the thing. Cancel that noise. That's manipulation. It's people trying to control you. It's people trying to gaslight you. You know, when someone consistently leaves you feeling bad about yourself, bad about the interaction, bad about your place in this world and in that relationship, If that's going on, change it. Maybe that means dropping it. Maybe that means limiting the amount of interaction. Maybe that means telling them that you've had about enough and you're not going to put up with that nonsense anymore. There are situations where any or all of those or other approaches would make sense. But bottom line, if it's not working for you, it's not working. And you have permission to act on that knowledge. You have the authority to act on that knowledge. Yeah, there's smarter and less smart ways to go about that, but you don't owe anybody putting up with nonsense that makes you feel bad about you.
Excellent, excellent place to start that off. And Lee, where do we take it from there?
Not really a lot to add to that. I completely and totally agree with where Jed took us there. And I would just encourage you to rewind it and listen to it again, especially if you're in this situation. It is true that like Jed's pointed out, and like you've said in your question, yes, everybody has wrong inside them. And if you're in a good relationship with someone, you're going to have moments where you have to face each other, confess, and forgive each other. That is absolutely reasonable. However, there are people who are not healthy, who want to create a space in your life that is not warranted, not good, exactly as Jed has described. So the only thing I want to add on to the end of this is, if you're a person who is walking with and trying to figure out what it means practically to follow Jesus, and you have the scriptures as an authority, what I want to tell you is, yes, the Bible does say that we should forgive everybody, but the scriptures are filled with precedents of you cutting certain types of people out of your life. And I want to be super clear about that. It's an important thing that you realize that there is a difference between forgiving someone, which is, that's an emotional state you get yourself to, between you and the Lord. I have rid myself from the need to get back at this person and to exact vengeance. I have released them from my vengeance. That's the way you need to think about forgiveness. I have released this person from my personal vengeance. And I know that sounds dramatic, but that's actually a really helpful way to think about this. That does not mean that we are going to be best friends. And if you have repeatedly demonstrated that you are an unhealthy person who does want to, exactly as the words Jeb was using, manipulate me or gaslight me or whatever those things are, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to set up certain boundaries between myself and yourself so that that cannot happen to me again. I don't want to be in unhealthy relationships. And what I'm telling you is, as a believer in Jesus, as a person who's trying to follow Jesus, as a person who sees the scriptures as a guide, an authority, and a seed of wisdom, the scriptures are filled with that stuff. So let me give you just a couple of things. If you, like, take a month this year that has 31 days in it, and just read one chapter of Proverbs per day. The book of Proverbs has 31 chapters. Read one book of Proverbs per day. What you're going to find really quickly is the book of Proverbs, which is just a book of wisdom from the Lord, is going to tell you a ton of times, do not invest your life with people who are unhealthy. Do not do that. Let me give you a really clear example out of the New Testament. This is from the book of a letter of Paul, the book of Titus, chapter 3, verse 10. Warn a divisive person once, and then warn them a second time. After that, have nothing to do with them. That's a very clear example in the New Testament, in these early churches that were starting, of the Apostle Paul, who wanted everybody to love each other and wanted everybody to forgive each other, of there are certain types of behavior that you cannot continue in relationship with. If someone has a certain type of behavior, you have to cut off your relationship with them. I just wanted to point a couple of those things out because as a way to just kind of bolster or add on to what Jed's saying, which I completely agree with, which is if you are looking at scripture, there is scriptural precedent. Yes, we're supposed to love everybody. Yes, we're supposed to forgive everybody. But there is scriptural precedent for us saying we cannot continue in a relationship any further.
Absolutely right. Jed, one more thing on this.
Yeah, and this is just to build on the great stuff that Lee was just saying. There's a kind of person, I've known a few in my life, that emits what I can only describe as a reality distortion field. Like, you have thought things through, you've sought wise counsel, you've prayed about it, you've talked to people you trust, you've talked to a therapist, you've figured out what it is, what you want to do, and yet you go and you talk to this person, and 10 minutes later, you're like, well, I mean, maybe I am a jerk. I was pretty sure I wasn't, but maybe I am. Like, there are people who have just a ridiculous ability to make you doubt yourself. Part of that is gaslighting, but part of it is just there's a vibe. And something to be aware of is that actually, this isn't the only version of it, but insecurity is something that kind of is catching. Like, there's a kind of insecurity where, like, if it's cranked up enough, like, it'll kind of rub off on you in the course of a conversation. And you can go in pretty certain what the truth is, what reality is, what you need to land on. And again, 10 minutes later, it's like, well, I guess, I don't know if that constitutes a toxic person or not, but what I can tell you from just a lot of hard won experience is if that's going on, be very careful. It is super easy for that to create a gravity unto itself and keep you stuck in a situation that's not good for you. Be mindful that there are plenty of troubled people in this world who just, they are lying to themselves so hard that it's convincing to them and to everybody in their orbit. They just emit a reality distortion field. And when you see that, be wary.
Wary indeed. Great stuff from both of these guys. And with that, we're going to move on to our final question for this week. It comes in and says, I know that faith healing isn't a thing, but Jesus does tell people, like the Father in Mark 9, that they have to believe for someone to be healed. So what does he mean by that? I think another great question. And before anyone goes out buying venomous snakes, let's give them a little hand and see what we may mean here. So Jedward, we kick this off.
Sure thing. So great question. There's a lot going on in Mark chapter 9. And you know, there's several stories in there, and there is a ton of stuff that is very much informed by the time and the culture in which the folks that are communicating and acting in Mark chapter 9, where that's coming from. So in other words, you and I are in essence reading that chapter as outsiders. Neither of us are living in first century Palestine. Neither of us have a perspective on either medical health or spiritual health of a person who lives in first century Palestine. I'm actually not saying that one is better than the other. I'm just saying that it is unavoidable that we have a very, very different perspective on things than the folks that are living out those stories. And I am super not a Bible scholar, so there's any number of really amazing commentaries that you can read. One of my personal favorites is William Barclay. I absolutely recommend that. You can check that out, but there's plenty of others. Many of them are available for free online. But in terms of a meta narrative, this is my opinion, but it is what I would share with you. And I think that it is germane to your question. I don't know that I have ever in my life seen a situation that was so bad that there was no way for it to be improved.
Mm.
I want to say that again. I want you to think about that. I don't think I've ever seen a situation anywhere that was so bad and so hopeless that it could in no way be improved. All of us on this podcast have actually spent a fair amount of time in some fairly extreme situations. I am including that as I say that. And in fact, I would go even farther to say, in those very rare situations where nothing circumstantial can be improved at all, one of the amazing things that you get from people like Viktor Frankl and his work, Man's Search for Meaning, is that when we reach a point where we feel like there's nothing that we can change in our circumstances, we still have the ability to influence our attitude about the situation in which we find ourselves. If you are on the green side of the grass, you always have some degree of agency. I think that most of the time you have some degree of agency about what's happening externally, but you always have some degree of agency about what's happening internally. And I want to be clear, I would hate it if someone said that to me. So if you don't like it as I'm saying it to you, you can boo me. I don't blame you. I understand. With that in mind, in almost all situations, improvement, internal or external, requires cooperation. For things to get better, we have to cooperate with a process that will get them better. And cooperation is predicated on the belief that things can get better. Mm. If you don't believe that things can improve even a little bit, you are probably not going to cooperate with the process that might lead to improvement. And if you're not cooperating with the process that's going to lead to improvement, they may not improve. Now, I want to be super duper crystal clear. I'm not saying that if things in your life suck, that's your fault because you're not cooperating with the process of improvement. An awful lot of suffering on planet Earth is completely unearned and undeserved. It is, it's a dark world, man. It's messed up and it's fallen, and awful stuff happens to people all the time for no reason at all. And if you're going through that, man, I am so sorry. And we're praying for you and we're standing with you. If there's a way that we can be a support to you and a way we can be a help to you, please reach out. We want to do that. Critically, if you are suffering, I am not saying in any way this is your fault at all.
That's right.
Not even a little bit. What I am saying is that when we find ourselves in moments of suffering, for me, there is hope that can be found in the idea of being able to say, look, I can't fix all of this, but maybe I can do something to improve it. Maybe we can take it from 99.9% awful to 99.8% awful, and I'll take every little bit that I can get. Improvement is almost always going to involve doing something. It's almost always going to involve cooperation with some kind of process, and we're probably not going to cooperate with it if we don't think that it can be improved in any way. Let's go back to Mark 9 for a second. Jesus says, you know, in your question, you state they have to believe for someone to be healed. I think that there's a lot of layers of meaning to that. Many of them are culturally specific. Many of them are spiritually above my pay grade. But I do think that there is that truth of one layer of the meaning there is, dude, if you want things to get better, you need to be prepared to engage in a process that could lead to them getting better. And if you don't think that that's going to be possible, you're probably not going to do that. One more point that I want to make, because I think Christians miss this a lot, is we all have a tendency to say in our heart of hearts, I don't want improvement. I want this fixed. This situation is awful and I hate it. Don't talk to me about Tylenol when my arm was just cut off. Like, don't, you know, I want you to miracle me out of this because it's awful. I want you to fix it right now. If that's how you feel, I get it. I understand. I have been there. I will probably be there again at some point. I am with you. Here's what I want you to think about. Every person that Jesus healed still died. Every single person that Jesus healed still died. There is no biblical reason, unless you're into really weird fan fiction, there is no biblical reason to think that a person Jesus healed in first century Palestine is still living on this mortal coil today. Every one of them died.
And why would they want to be perfectly honest?
Man, from your lips to God's ears, absolutely. Every person that Jesus healed still died, which means Jesus was offering improvement. Jesus was offering improvement to them. He's offering improvement to me. He's offering improvement to you. Jesus is offering improvement. Paradise in the Christian faith comes on the other side of all this. That moment when there's no more hurt or sickness or pain, that comes in eternity. That doesn't come here on planet Earth. What comes here on planet Earth, the thing that's on offer is improvement, is comfort. And if we can find a way to participate in that process, we can probably begin to live into that. But that begins by believing that improvement and comfort is possible.
Yeah.
Yes. And that is a good, not only a very wise answer, but a good example of why we're never going to get the ad spots that we can pull from this show, because there's nothing less a social media ad than, well, let's talk about small incremental changes over time. Just not going to get the ad dollars rolling in, but it is a great answer. And Lee, where do we close this out?
It's fantastic stuff, man. I totally agree. Let me start here and underline this three times. God has your back. He has your back. And what's more, he's not measuring your faith levels to determine whether or not he has your back. He wants what's good for you. He wants what's healthy for you. He wants what brings about your personal growth and your personal peace. He is not waiting on you to impress him. He is not testing you so that you know, if you pass the test at a certain level, then he'll hook you up more or whatever. We need to start there before we can actually look at the words that Jesus says to this man in this story. God has your back. He cares about you. He loves you. And as we've talked about so many times over the years on this show, to love someone is to want their absolute best for them. Okay, so let's look at Jesus' words in this story. He says, anything is possible for the one who believes. So are we to interpret that as the harder you believe, the more you can just make things appear in the material world, or the more you can just make things happen almost by magic? I don't think so. I don't think that's what's happening here, because people believe stuff and it doesn't materialize. The plainest way to look at the unified testimony of the scriptures is to believe in the Lord is not a Herculean task. It's not some huge thing that you know, if you were stronger, you could do a little bit more of it. To believe in the Lord is a very simple, basic thing. It is to say, I believe God loves me. I believe Jesus paid for me. I believe the Lord wants a relationship with me. That's really it. That's really that's the whole kit and caboodle right there. That's just it. It's like, I believe God loves me. I believe Jesus paid for me. I believe the Lord wants a relationship with me. That's the whole thing. And like access to that relationship comes through that simple little faith. It's not, do you believe that thing harder than the next person? Then I will hook you up more. No, I believe God wants what's best for me. I believe he's smarter than I am. I believe he has a plan and he knows what he's doing. I don't always know what that is. I don't know. I'm not always happy with the way that that whole thing works out. But faith in the Lord means I believe he wants a relationship with me. And so I'm gonna hang everything on that. That doesn't mean I'm always going to get every single little momentary thing that I want in my life if I just grit my teeth and I want that hard enough. The truth is, God loves you and he wants to hook you up. He wants to hook you up with peace. He wants to hook you up with love. He wants to hook you up with health and like healthy things in your life, not necessarily physical health in your body. He doesn't always do that. It's just believing in him is believing that he loves you, believing that he wants to know you. It's that kind of simple stuff that gives you access to a relationship. That's all. It's not believing it harder. It's not believing it more. It's not believing it to where like the needle moves from the green zone to the yellow zone to the red zone. That's not what we're talking about here. It's just a very simple thing. I believe God loves me. I believe he wants what's best for me. I believe that I'm going to end up in that place that Jed described, where there are no more pains and there aren't, and my questions get answered. Until then, I'm going to have a lot of questions, and I don't think that he's asking me to impress him with how far my faith can throw a ball or whatever. I don't even, the prospect of some of this faith healing stuff is so ludicrous that I don't know how to answer it. Faith is a very small thing. I believe God loves me. That's it. Now I have access to a relationship where God is my friend and we walk through my life together. That's the whole thing. God loves you. He wants to hook you up. Hold on to that and keep walking through your life.
Absolutely beautifully put from both of these guys. If you have a question for us, say at podcast@gmail.com. Take out the song this week. This is from Lee called Can This Be? Take out that. Thanks for listening. Just remember, we love you. God loves you. There's nothing you can do.
I wouldn't have chosen a heart like mine. I wouldn't have loved me the way you do. I don't get this right very much of the time. But Jesus, I do love you. Can this be? When I was nothing good or true, you wanted me. Jesus, I love you. Have promised a wayward soul forgiveness no matter what they do. But you're not like me, you make broken hearts whole. And Jesus, I do love you. Can this be? I grace. I love 'cause you loved me. I need you today. I live by your mercy. I'm saved by your grace. I love 'cause you loved me.